Anything less, MacArthur implied, was tantamount to appeasement. In a letter that was read on the floor of the House of Representatives by its recipient, Congressman Joseph W. Martin, Jr. of Massachusetts, MacArthur stated, "Asia is where the communist conspirators have elected to make their play for global conquest. If we lose the war to communism in Asia, the fall of Europe is inevitable." In a shocking act of disrespect, MacArthur rebuked Truman for his unwillingness to take the fight directly to the Chinese. Truman could take no more of this. On April 11th, the president relieved MacArthur of his command, setting off one of the biggest controversies of the decade. For MacArthur was not just an army officer. To his admirers, he was an icon, the most storied military man of his generation, the liberator of the Philippines, the proconsul of the American occupation of Japan, and the daring strategist who had rescued a precarious American position in Korea. His dismissal triggered an eruption of hostility toward Truman across the country. "It is doubtful if there has ever been in this country so violent and spontaneous a discharge of political passion as that provoked by Truman's action," according to two sharp contemporary observers. The American citizen took MacArthur's recall as if it were an outrage to his own person. Telegrams calling for the president's impeachment poured into Congress. Senator Joe McCarthy, the right-wing red hunter who had been attacking the administration for over a year for allegedly coddling communists, called the president a son of a bitch and declared the firing the greatest victory the communists have ever won. Some Republicans now believed that MacArthur should challenge Truman for the presidency. Sympathetic congressmen engineered an invitation to the general to speak to a joint session of Congress. There on April 19th, MacArthur, newly arrived stateside from his Asian posting, delivered an astonishing valedictory. When China intervened in the Korean War, MacArthur said, he had demanded a bold new military strategy to deal with this threat, but was denied. Thus, Korea had become an indecisive campaign with its terrible and constant attrition. Truman's allegedly passive defensive attitude was to MacArthur an outrage. His peroration rang through the halls of Congress and echoed across the country. "Once war is forced upon us, there is no other alternative than to apply every available means to bring it to a swift end. War's very object is victory, not prolonged indecision. In war, there is no substitute for victory." The following day, MacArthur traveled to New York City and was met with a reception even more rollicking and tempestuous than that which Eisenhower had enjoyed in 1945. Millions of New Yorkers acclaimed MacArthur a returning hero as his open car drove slowly through 15 miles of city streets under a hail of confetti. Steamboats and tugs in the harbor belched thunderous bass notes of welcome. Fireboats sprayed jets of water in the air. Columns of marching bands blared triumphant music. At the steps of St. Patrick's Cathedral, where the general dismounted from his car, Francis Cardinal Spellman and six bishops welcomed the general and clasped his hands as if anointing him with holy powers. 3. The Truman-MacArthur imbroglio roiled the waters of domestic politics. Truman's approval rating sank below 30% and stayed there for all of 1951. His weakened position opened the path to a Republican presidential victory in 1952, but so far, the only serious contender was Robert Taft. He had angled for the nomination three times before, losing out to Wendell Willkie in 1940. And Thomas Dewey in 1944 and 1948. Perhaps many in the GOP argued it was Taft's turn. He had much support in the conservative and isolationist Midwestern and Western states. The Democrats had been in control of the executive since 1933, and the country seemed ready for a change. Surely 1952 would be a Republican year. The thought of a Taft presidency alarmed Eisenhower's closest friends, none more so than Lucius Clay. Since returning from running the American occupation forces in Germany in 1949, General Clay had been working as CEO of the Continental Can Company and serving on various corporate boards. He was one of Eisenhower's closest and most savvy wartime colleagues, supremely intelligent, politically sensitive, his father had been a senator, and enormously respected for his wisdom and organizational skill. He was also one of the great architects of America's position in Europe. He had helped implement the Marshall Plan, helped cement the Western Alliance and NATO, and was a stout believer in the Western security program Eisenhower was now building. Clay believed that if Taft became president, all this work would be wiped away. "We cannot let the isolationists gain control of government if we are to endure as a free people over the years," he wrote Eisenhower in mid-1951. Within weeks, Clay had formed a small group of moderate Republicans to start organizing a political campaign committee to win the GOP nomination for Eisenhower. "This involves no commitment on your part," Clay reassured the general. But there was urgency in his message. "It is time to move now." Eisenhower, on active duty in Europe as the NATO commander, could not condone such partisan activity. But while he told Clay that his own personal attitude toward a political career was flatly negative, he left the door open a crack. "Now, as to what others may or should do, I have always insisted upon the right of every free-born American to do what he pleases," he went on somewhat unpersuasively. "I am not trying to duck any difficult question or to be evasive or coy. My present duty is to help develop the defensive power of 12 countries. If I ever have to do any other, I shall have to be very clear that I know it to be a duty." Did Eisenhower want to be president? He said repeatedly to his closest friends that he did not want a political career. But he was not immune to the arguments that reached him in Paris. He believed the country's global interests would be profoundly harmed by a Taft presidency, and he believed Truman's leadership on domestic policy had been disastrous. He wanted the country to move in a sharply different direction. He understood his own popular appeal and was sensitive to the clamoring of hundreds of friends and acquaintances that he was the right leader for these difficult times. But he had serious reservations. His reputation could be tarnished by a bruising political fight. Politics was a dirty business, and he had little respect for its leading practitioners. He had already given 40 years of service to his country and was ready for an easier life. There was also the possibility that if he ran for office, he might lose. In mid-1951, the pressure on him mounted. In late June, Bill Robinson spent 10 days with Eisenhower in Paris. During golf, luxurious dinners at Le Coq Ardy, a few trips to the horse races, and a short jaunt to London, the two friends regularly talked politics. Robinson updated Eisenhower on Dewey's efforts behind the scenes to stop Taft. Robinson told him directly that he had not the slightest doubt that Ike would be nominated by the Republicans and would be elected. He suggested that Eisenhower make his plans for the future on that assumption. Just 2 days after Robinson left Paris, Massachusetts Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr. called on the general at his SHAPE headquarters. Lodge was a close associate of Dewey and was known as a promising young talent in liberal Republican circles. He knew Eisenhower very slightly from the war years when Lodge had been a junior officer. But now Lodge felt it a duty to press him to run for president. Eisenhower was surprisingly eager to talk politics. He and Lodge spoke from 9 a.m. until lunch, after which Lodge stayed for further conversation. He left the meeting feeling that Eisenhower would be open to a draft from the Republican Party, though Ike's refusal to campaign would make winning the nomination difficult. Clay drove this point home and made a proposal to Eisenhower that only a close and respected friend could have suggested. "I would hope that sometime in the early part of next year, You would request your release from the NATO command. No matter how badly you may be needed in Europe, you are needed even more here, and perhaps if you do not return, nothing accomplished there would have any real permanency. Soon after, Ed Birmingham beseeched Eisenhower to declare his party affiliation so he could be registered in party primaries across the country. Such a statement would unloose the energies and activities of your friends all over America, who want to get the delegate machinery moving in your behalf. Eisenhower tried to resist these entreaties, but in his diary he revealed that the pressure was getting to him. He wrote plaintively, "It is not easy to just say no." In mid-October, Eisenhower gave his friends the first real sign that he could be persuaded to enter the political battle. The occasion was a visit from a West Point graduate and fellow Army football player, General Edwin N. Clark, to Ike's headquarters in Paris. Clark had served on Eisenhower's staff in the war, then practiced law and run an international consulting business. He brought to Eisenhower a message from James Duff, a senator from Pennsylvania and a former governor. Duff had been working hard in Congress to peel away moderate and liberal Republicans from Taft and bring them to Eisenhower's side. To do this effectively, he needed the general's personal assurance that Eisenhower was a Republican and that he would run if drafted. So far, Eisenhower had refused to give any such assurances. But Clark had more success. After a marathon session, Clark and Eisenhower worked out a statement that was to be given in strictest secrecy to Senator Duff. The letter, in Eisenhower's handwriting, was dated October 14, 1951, his 61st birthday. It stated, "I have been and am an adherent to the Republican Party and to liberal Republican principles." He reiterated his inability to campaign for the nomination while on active duty. However, he promised that if nominated, "I would resign my commission and assume aggressive leadership of the party." Clark promptly returned to the United States, showed the letter to Duff, and locked it away for safekeeping. There could be little doubt now. Eisenhower was preparing to run for president. Truman, his canny instincts bristling, sensed the political threat Ike posed. The president remained uncertain whether he would run for re-election in 1952. His decision depended largely on Eisenhower. In November, he summoned Ike to Washington, supposedly for a meeting on NATO matters. The reunion was overshadowed by a new poll from Gallup reporting that if Eisenhower ran against Truman in 1952, he would capture 64% of the vote, against a mere 28% for Truman. On November 5th, the two men had a private lunch at Blair House and spent more than an hour closeted together. No record was kept of the meeting, and Eisenhower later denied there had been any political talk. They discussed NATO and national security issues, he said. In fact, Truman did ask Eisenhower about his political intentions, and he went further. The president would bow out of the race if Eisenhower accepted the Democratic nomination. Eisenhower, probably appalled that Truman would bring up the subject, replied that he had serious differences with the Democrats on domestic politics, especially on labor and social issues, and he could not accept such a scenario. He tried to change the subject, and Truman let it drop. Ike affected a lack of interest in politics for Truman's benefit, but immediately after his lunch with the president, he flew to New York, and while parked on the tarmac of LaGuardia Airport in his official airplane, the Columbine, he held an impromptu strategy session with his close friends. Bill Robinson, Cliff Roberts, and his brother Milton, among others, talked to him for 3 hours about politics and the plan now in place for winning the nomination. Eisenhower continued to say that he would not actively campaign, but by now he was clearly giving enough support to the draft effort to banish the idea that he was merely a disinterested bystander. With Eisenhower's words that he would accept a draft from the Republican Party, the momentum began to pick up. In a press conference on November 17th, Lodge announced the formation of an Eisenhower for President organization. Wearing an "I like Ike" button on his lapel, the tall Bostonian declared, "We've got a candidate, and we've got the one who is sure to win. I know he is a Republican, period. I can assert that flatly. There is no doubt about that." Working out of the Commodore Hotel in New York, the organization picked up speed. Dewey, much loathed by the old guard Republicans, kept a low profile so as not to tarnish the operation. But behind the scenes, he provided talent and access to wealthy backers. The money began rolling in, much of it from John H. "Jock" Whitney, the multimillionaire heir to the Payne Whitney fortune, and Sid Richardson, the Fort Worth oil man. The group reached out to Sigurd Lahrman of the Young and Rubicam advertising agency, which would play a major role in the election, churning out billboards, radio and television commercials, and reams of newspaper ads pushing Eisenhower's candidacy. From New York, tentacles reached out across the country to coordinate Citizens for Eisenhower groups. Eisenhower was kept abreast of all these developments by various correspondents, and while he continued to profess no interest in politics, he did tell Robinson that he could imagine enjoying the freedom to be outspoken once again. "If I ever get into this business, I am going to start swinging from the hips, and I am going to keep swinging until completely counted out." The New Hampshire primary, set for March 11, 1952, would be a crucial test of Eisenhower's appeal among rank-and-file Republicans. The issue of placing Eisenhower's name on the ballot in New Hampshire had triggered a detailed round of secretive correspondence and plotting among the many cooks in the Eisenhower for President kitchen. Over the Christmas holidays of 1951, Robinson had spent 5 days in Paris with Eisenhower. Upon his return, he reported back to the team in New York, "Eisenhower agreed to be placed on the ballot in New Hampshire." This was breaking news, the first public confirmation by Eisenhower of his party affiliation. Life magazine, owned by the admiring Henry Luce, rushed out a powerful endorsement of Eisenhower's candidacy, giving 4 reasons why Ike should be president. "He understands war. His administrative ability, his political principles, and his gift for leadership." Eisenhower understood that the first requirement of leadership was moral strength, the conviction that we are right. He himself surely possessed this virtue. What a boost he could give to the national morale. The storm was gaining force, but on January 7, 1952, Eisenhower released a message of his own. Buried inside a few paragraphs of the usual statements about his devotion to NATO and his inability to campaign in person, he confirmed his party affiliation and acknowledged that a nomination to be the Republican candidate for president would constitute a duty that would transcend my present responsibility. Somewhat reluctantly, he had set in motion a great national effort that would carry him to the White House. 4. Winning the nomination for president is hard enough for an active and willing candidate. Eisenhower was neither. He seemed to think that he could be drafted as the GOP nominee without having to lift a finger. But the odds were sharply against the draft. The only 20th-century presidential candidate to be offered his party's nomination without openly seeking it was Charles Evans Hughes, who, then serving on the Supreme Court, was drafted as the 1916 Republican nominee to face President Woodrow Wilson. And Hughes had been a consensus candidate, facing little opposition. Eisenhower's forces, by contrast, had to contend with the determined and resourceful Taft machine. His legions of backers in New York knew that to be nominated, Ike would have to get off his high horse and descend into the muck of politics. To persuade Ike of the groundswell in his favor, a group of well-heeled enthusiasts concocted a rather brazen effort to charm the reluctant candidate. On February 8th, with an eye on the New Hampshire primary just 4 weeks away, They staged a rally in New York's Madison Square Garden to demonstrate the wide base of Eisenhower's popular appeal. Billed as a serenade to Ike, the affair was organized by John Tex McCrary and his stunning wife, the model and actress Jinx Falkenberg, who together had pioneered a number of radio and television talk shows. McCrary was a Texan but had schooled at Exeter and Yale, where he joined the DKE fraternity, was tapped for Skull and Bones, and played football. He was a journalist, editor, and public relations consultant with wealthy friends like fellow Yalee Jock Whitney, who bankrolled the event. McCrary made sure the serenade was broadcast by NBC to radio and television markets in a dozen major cities, though with the time difference, Eisenhower in France was sleeping soundly while the raucous event unfolded. McCrary used his connections to rope in some of the country's most famous talent to tout the Ike for President movement. Clark Gable, Henry Fonda, Ethel Merman, television hostess Faye Emerson, Noel Coward, and a dozen other high-profile entertainers popped up on the stage. Fred Waring, the universally popular bandleader, acted as MC for the night and led the audience in songs from the popular Broadway shows South Pacific and The King and I. Merman belted out, "There's no business like show business," to delirious applause. Irving Berlin crooned a humorous confection called "What Else? I Like Ike," and was joined on stage by a comical Truman lookalike who received the loud jeers of the crowd. To top it off, the composer Richard Rodgers accompanied singer and Broadway actress Mary Martin in a rendition of "I'm in Love with a Wonderful Guy," the theme of the night. By all accounts, this foolishness was a great success, not so much for its impact on the electorate as for its impact on Eisenhower. 2 days after the rally, on February 11th, Jacqueline Cochran, a former World War II flying ace, pioneer of the Women's Air Force service pilots, and a close collaborator of McCrary's in mounting the serenade, picked up reels of film of the whole event, boarded a TWA flight to Paris, and arrived breathlessly at SHAPE headquarters with what Eisenhower called burning enthusiasm and the spirit of the crusader. Eisenhower knew Cochran from the war years and was also close to her husband, the wealthy investor and utilities owner Floyd Odlum. Watching the film of the serenade with Mamie at his side in the theater they had installed in their Paris residence, Eisenhower was overcome by the outpouring of enthusiasm he saw among the New York well-wishers. He broke down, openly sobbing in front of his guest. Cochran did not hesitate. She pressed him to declare himself a candidate, resign from the NATO command, and return to the United States to campaign. After a long and emotional conversation, Eisenhower concurred. He told her he would run. The next day he composed a brief note in his diary. "Viewing the film finally developed into a real emotional experience for Mamie and me. I've not been so upset in years. Clearly to be seen is the mass longing of America for some kind of reasonable solution for her nagging, persistent, and almost terrifying problems. It's a real experience to realize that one could become a symbol for many thousands of the hopes they have." On February 16th, just 4 days after Cochran's dramatic visit, Eisenhower arranged to meet Clay in London, where Eisenhower was attending the funeral services of King George VI, meeting secretly in the home of Brigadier James Galt, Eisenhower's British military aide. Clay pushed Eisenhower to settle the issue once and for all. Would he come home to run for the nomination? It took some hours of heated discussion before Eisenhower agreed. "He dreaded a campaign," Clay recalled later. "He'd never been in one, and it represented a rather awesome undertaking. And I think he didn't like being pressed for a decision. As a matter of fact, he got quite provoked with me when I kept on insisting that we had to have a decision." Eisenhower finally told Clay he would ask Truman to be relieved of his post. He would then resign his commission and return to the United States around June 1st, after a crucial round of NATO meetings was wrapped up. At long last, after a year or more of prevarication and delay, he was ready to get into the fight. "I only ask," he wrote to Clay a few days later, "that you people regard my own positions with some sympathy." 5. Eisenhower's decision to seek the GOP nomination could not yet be made public. He wanted to finish his NATO assignment without the distraction that his resignation would create, and he needed Truman's permission to relinquish his command. So even though he knew he was going to run, he continued to feign indifference toward the political dogfight now shaping up in the Republican primary in New Hampshire. As it happened, that contest of March 11, 1952, would have a major impact on the course of the election. Both parties had candidates on the primary ballot in New Hampshire. Truman's name would appear for the Democrats, though he had made no formal announcement of his intention to run for re-election. His challenger was the Tennessee Senator Estes Kefauver, a political maverick who had made himself a national figure by chairing the televised Senate Special Committee on Organized Crime. Truman's low popularity made him vulnerable, but no one gave Kefauver much of a chance against the sitting president. The fact that Kefauver was a Southerner and campaigned while wearing a coonskin cap only emphasized his eccentricity and novelty in New England. In the Republican primary, voters would elect 14 delegates to send to the National Convention in Chicago in July. The ballot also featured a beauty contest, a simple expression of preference for president. The stakes were high. Not only were delegates to be accumulated, but the winning candidate would gain valuable momentum going into the subsequent primary contests. With Eisenhower mutely observing from France, Taft had the field almost to himself, and he swung into the primary with confidence and a strong message. The weather during his three-day tour through the state was cold and wet, with snowdrifts melting into the thick slush of early spring. But his stump speech was red hot, and he gave it 30 times in as many towns. Taft ran as the true conservative in the race, and a man of principle who would offer a sharp contrast to the Democrats. He promised voters that he would launch an all-out attack on the unlimited spending and taxing of the bureaucratic regulation of the Fair Deal, on the disastrous foreign policy which has led to Russian power and unnecessary war, and on the immorality of this administration. In a swipe at Dewey and the liberal Republicans, Taft declared, "We cannot win by a modification of our principles. We must shun a Me Too campaign," such as Dewey had run in 1948, that only sought to continue the FDR legacy of the New Deal. It was time to stop the growth of government, time to end the terrible war in Korea, and time to throw out an administration that had been dominated by a strange communist sympathy. Taft reserved a number of pointed barbs for Eisenhower. "You would not choose someone," he told the rain-soaked crowd in Laconia on March 6th, "who never ran for office in his life and doesn't know how to conduct a campaign." Besides, Ike had expressed no political views at all and had worked closely with Democratic administrations. With Eisenhower still in Paris, the Ike for President team relied on the powerful influence of New Hampshire's governor, Sherman Adams. A pro-Eisenhower Republican, he had selected a very strong and well-known slate of candidates whose names were on the ballot as Eisenhower delegates. Many were proven vote-getters. They included Adams himself, the former governor, Robert O. Blood, Representative Norris Cotton, and the head of Phillips Exeter Academy, William Saltonstall. On the night of March 10th, a heavy blanket of wet snow fell, but this did not depress the turnout on the following day. Twice as many voters came out to the polls as in the primary of 1948, and the results were stunning. Not only did Eisenhower sweep the delegates, winning all 14, but he topped the popularity poll decisively, garnering 46,661 votes to Taft's 35,838. Perhaps more significant for the 1952 national election, Kefauver edged out Truman, winning even labor-heavy districts in Manchester. The president had not campaigned in New Hampshire, but even so it was a blow to lose to a dark horse senator from the backwoods of Tennessee. Eisenhower had been helped by his enormous popularity, by the argument that only he could beat the Democrats, by the strength of his slate of delegates, and by Taft's stiffness and wooden manner on the stump. Taft later implied that Governor Adams had arm-twisted state employees to vote for Eisenhower, and the right-wing Manchester Union leader darkly hinted that unnamed Wall Street bankers had flooded the state with slush funds for Eisenhower. But saner observers understood the significance of the vote. Walter Lippmann, the dean of national political columnists, asked rhetorically, "Is there any serious doubt that Eisenhower is the Republican who has by all odds the best chance to capitalize upon the discontent within the Democratic Party?" Lippmann went on, putting words to what Eisenhower himself had already concluded. He was no longer just a popular general, but an active candidate, and so should no longer be in uniform. He must ask the president to relieve him of his military command. In Paris, Eisenhower took careful notice of what was going on. In mid-March, he sent a discreet letter to New York lawyer Herbert Brownell, inviting him to his headquarters. Brownell, a longtime Republican power broker and the manager of Dewey's 1948 campaign against Truman, had been working with Clay and others to get Eisenhower into the race. He quickly accepted Ike's invitation and made his way to Paris, incognito, for a meeting with the general on March 24th. The two men had a confidential and extremely candid exchange of views. Over the course of a full day, they discussed politics, ideas, and strategy. Brownell leveled with Eisenhower. He would not get the nomination through a draft. If he wanted it, he would have to campaign for it. Taft might have lost the beauty contest in New Hampshire, but he already had 40% of the delegates needed to win the nomination, and Ike could not delay declaring his candidacy any longer. Truman, too, had a decision to make. The double blows of New Hampshire, the Eisenhower and Kefauver victories, had concentrated his mind. If he were to run for re-election, he would not only face a wildly popular war hero and political superstar, but he would have to lead a badly divided Democratic Party into the campaign. Kefauver's win in Yankee New Hampshire had shown the Northern liberals and labor supporters were ready for a change of leadership, and down in Dixie just a few weeks earlier, Senator Richard Russell of Georgia, an opponent of Truman's civil rights policies, had announced his own candidacy. The segregationists in the Democratic Party were once again threatening to secede as they had done under the Dixiecrat Strom Thurmond in 1948. It was a depressing political landscape, even for a talent as wily and indefatigable as Truman. At the annual Jefferson Jackson Day dinner on March 29, 1952, Truman made his announcement. He rose to the podium at 10:30 at night before a crowd of 6,000 elegantly attired party faithful who had just dined on beef tenderloin, baked potatoes and ice cream molded into the shape of a donkey. After a long-winded and barbed attack on the Republican Party, and a full-throated defense of his own record, he declared his decision to retire from the fray. "I shall not be a candidate for re-election." Truman had concluded that Eisenhower would run, and that he would win. The president could not have been surprised to find, just 2 days later, a letter from Eisenhower on his desk, dated April 2, 1952. "I am requesting the Secretary of Defense to initiate action to bring about my relief from my current post as Supreme Commander, Allied Powers Europe, on or about June 1st of this year." "It makes me rather sad," Truman replied in a handwritten note, perhaps thinking not only about his own departure from office, but about the decision of one of his idols to step into the dirty work of politics. "I hope you will be happy in your new role." Chapter 4. Crusade. "You have summoned me on behalf of millions of your fellow Americans to lead a great crusade." 1. It has long been asserted that Eisenhower swept into the White House as the 34th president on a wave of personal popularity, rather than for any set of ideas or policies. Certainly Eisenhower was popular, universally known and admired for his war service. Yet in the election of 1952, he did not rely on his reputation as an apolitical soldier to stay above the fray of the campaign. Quite the opposite. Rather than playing it safe, rising above faction and controversy, coasting on his name recognition, Eisenhower jumped into the mess of electoral politics with gusto. In running for president, he was vehement, polemical, and partisan. He lambasted the Truman administration, heaped abuse on the New Deal, and curried favor with the right wing of his party. Why did he do so? Eisenhower deeply believed in the conservative, small government, balanced budget positions he celebrated on the hustings. He maintained an instinctive aversion toward New Deal policies and bureaucracies. But he was a much shrewder politician than he let on. In 1952, he effectively pulled off a brilliant political conjuring trick. He pretended to be a nonpartisan political amateur, just an old soldier incapable of duplicity, while in fact he followed a ruthless and successful strategy. Attack your opponent relentlessly, stress ideological themes in order to stir up enthusiasm in the base, and promise to fix the mess in Washington. He posed as an outsider, speaking for the average American. For a man who had been a government employee since 1915, and who had worked in Washington for many years, whose friends were among the wealthiest power brokers in the nation, and who had aligned himself closely with Truman's foreign policies, this was as neat a political bait and switch as American politics has seen in the 20th century. And Ike did it all with a smile. His campaign for president started in Abilene on June 4, 1952, a date the hometown selectmen hastily named Eisenhower Day. 50,000 people flocked to this quiet Kansas hamlet to see the great war leader open his bid for the White House. Every hotel and rooming house for 40 miles was booked by reporters and television crews. Hawkers of popcorn, candy apples, foot-long hot dogs, and trinkets lined Abilene's main street. Two Republican elephants were shipped into town on a long trailer from Kelly's Circus in Holyoke, Colorado. Eisenhower, who had returned from Paris to Washington on the 1st of June, flew into Kansas City that morning and took a special train to Abilene. It was set to be a terrific day. An hour before the general was scheduled to make his nationally televised speech to a crowd of well-wishers in Abilene's stadium, a generous term for an open field of weeds and dirt ringed by a few bleachers, the skies erupted. Rain poured down, churning the ground into ankle-deep black mud. Onlookers fled for their cars or nearby shelters, leaving Ike almost alone on a simple wooden platform, a few flags snapping in the wet wind behind him. "Like his invasion of Europe 8 years ago," one reporter quipped, "General Eisenhower's political invasion of the Middle West turned out this afternoon to be an amphibious operation." It was a miserable start, and it looked even worse on television, as Eisenhower donned a pair of foggy spectacles, bowed his head and read out a long prepared speech devoid of much punch or pizzazz. A few wisps of hair blew from his bald pate, and his wet slicker made him look like an elderly crossing guard on a windswept street corner. Back in New York, Governor Dewey and his team of professionals were appalled as they watched the speech. Herbert Brownell, who was going to play a central role in getting Ike elected, recalled that everything went wrong. It was absolutely dismal, he said of the kickoff event. About as disappointing an opening campaign speech as I've ever experienced. Through the rain and wind, though, Eisenhower's speech carried an accusation. 20 years of Democratic rule, from Roosevelt's New Deal to Truman's Fair Deal, had left America feeble, anxious, and vulnerable. The nation faced terrible problems, he asserted, from persistent labor unrest to unchecked inflation, a spike in taxes, a bloated national debt, the spreading tentacles of a grasping bureaucracy, and pernicious corruption inside the federal government. All these problems he laid at Truman's doorstep. It was time, Eisenhower argued, to scale back the government and return to thrift, frugality, and economy. James Reston of the New York Times likened the speech to an old revivalist Chautauqua meeting, in which the virtues of frugality, austerity, honesty, economy, simplicity, integrity were solemnly invoked. The next day, Eisenhower held his first press conference as a candidate in Abilene's Plaza Theater and revealed his skill at handling the news media. The Eisenhower team wanted to dispel accusations from the Taft camp that Ike was out of touch with America's problems after his long service overseas. To the astonishment of his interrogators, Eisenhower was masterful. He reaffirmed his lifelong support for the Republican Party and its principles, saying he had never voted the Democratic ticket. He spoke frankly about the Korean War, insisting that there was no clear-cut answer to the conflict because of the size and scale of the Chinese military forces now in the region. Asked about civil rights legislation, he gave what would become a sort of mantra for him. "I do not believe we can cure all of the evils in men's hearts by law." This was both his personal belief and a pitch to Southern white voters that he would be no crusader in this field. In reply to a question about compulsory national health insurance, a policy Truman wanted but failed to secure, Eisenhower invoked his opposition to socialism. "Beyond pure socialism lies, I believe, dictatorship." He deftly reaffirmed his anti-communist credentials while distancing himself from Joe McCarthy. "No one could be more determined than I am that any kind of communistic, subversive influence be uprooted," he said. "But it could be done without besmirching the reputation of any innocent man." Combined with his opening speech, this press conference aimed to deflect Taft's accusation that Eisenhower was just another Me Too Republican, willing to accept the legacy of the New Deal. Ike tried to reassure the old guard Republicans and put the Democrats on notice that he intended to bring the fight to them. Watching Eisenhower in action, Stuart Alsop, writing in the New York Herald Tribune, called him the most effective personality to emerge on the political scene since the death of Franklin Roosevelt. "He had a kind of political magic," Alsop wrote, "evident from the electric undercurrent of excitement that filled the room. His words mattered less than his sincerity and his lack of guile." Alsop concluded, "He will be a remarkably hard man to beat." 2. And yet there was nothing inevitable in his winning the Republican nomination at the National Convention in Chicago in July. While Eisenhower had been stationed at NATO headquarters in Paris, Senator Taft had been working hard to secure the commitment of state delegates across the country. Taft had won many state primaries and had used his enviable political connections with governors, senators, and congressmen to nail down an impressive slate of committed delegates. The states would send 1,206 delegates to the convention. A nominee would need 604 to win. By the time Eisenhower gave his speech in Abilene, Taft could say with some confidence that he had already lined up 500 delegates. Eisenhower showed strength in northeastern and mid-Atlantic states and the Pacific coast, and had won almost 400 delegates. But Taft was ahead. "The campaign has gone just about as we programmed it," Taft said. He expected to have the nomination within reach by the time the convention opened. With both sides fighting so fiercely for every slight advantage, it was perhaps inevitable that a bit of old-fashioned political chicanery would erupt into a national scandal just a few weeks before the convention. In Texas, with 38 delegates at stake, the Republican Party was deeply divided over which candidate to support. In local precinct elections, the voters went for Eisenhower, but the party bosses were pro-Taft, and they appointed a Taft slate of delegates anyway, claiming that many Democrats had voted for Ike in the primary, they were legally allowed to do so, and had thus skewed the results. The Eisenhower forces promptly labeled the affair the Texas Steal. So serious was the issue that Eisenhower himself traveled to Dallas in late June to give a searing speech denouncing the tactics of a small clique of Texas Republicans who were trying to steal delegates. He pointed out that no party could clean up the government of the United States unless that party, from top to bottom, is clean itself. In the meantime, the pro-Eisenhower forces in Texas named a rival delegation to go to the National Convention, where they would continue the fight to be recognized. This nasty conflict loomed as the convention opened. There was further drama over which side would win the votes of state delegations controlled by favorite sons, that is, state leaders who had won their own state primaries and whose name would be placed in nomination in the distant hope that a rally to them might occur at the convention. Governor Earl Warren of California held 70 delegates, a powerful voting bloc in a tight race, and former Minnesota Governor Harold Stassen held 28. The Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Louisiana delegates were uncommitted or in dispute, and in the close race it was unclear which way these vital votes would turn. Taft's men dominated the Republican National Committee, but the dynamics of a convention were impossible to predict. The pressure was on. Everything would come down to the politicking on the floor of the convention, which opened on a blazing hot July 7th in the International Amphitheater in Chicago's South Side, just across the street from the vast, reeking works of the Union Stockyards. With Eisenhower ensconced in his suite of rooms in the Blackstone Hotel and watching the convention on television, the 4 days of mayhem and chaos began. The first stage of the battle was led by the clever veteran Brownell. He had been Dewey's campaign manager in 1948 and had intimate knowledge of how the convention process worked. It was his idea to attack Taft's weakness, his reliance upon delegations whose votes were contested. Brownell wrote a fair play amendment to the convention rules that proposed that contested delegates not be allowed to vote on the seating of other contested delegates. It was a technicality, but an important one, for it meant that only secure and legitimate delegates would be allowed to vote on which slate of delegates, Taft's or Eisenhower's, would be seated from the contested states. Brownell and his allies, especially Governor Sherman Adams of New Hampshire and Arthur Langley of Washington, appealed to the convention on moral grounds. The GOP nominee would fight the Democrats on the issue of corruption, so he had to guarantee integrity in his own campaign. This accusation put the Taft forces back on their heels. In a series of narrow votes, the convention agreed to accept the fair play language and awarded to Eisenhower the delegates from Louisiana, Georgia, and Texas. The tumultuous first day was, as Brownell put it, a disastrous day for Taft. He was stuck 100 votes short of the nomination, and the momentum was moving swiftly toward Eisenhower. Behind the scenes, Brownell, Dewey, Adams, Henry Cabot Lodge, and the Eisenhower team now put intense pressure on the delegates to get on the Eisenhower bandwagon. They made a simple and powerful argument. Taft could not win a national election, and Eisenhower could. With Ike on the ticket, the Republicans would be back in the White House after 20 years. It worked. Early in the afternoon of Friday, July 11th, the balloting began, and as state after state voted, it became clear that Eisenhower was leading. Slightly. By the time the last delegate had spoken, the Virgin Islands named its single delegate for Eisenhower, the vote stood at 595 for Eisenhower, 500 for Taft, 81 for Earl Warren, 20 for Harold Stassen, and 10 for Douglas MacArthur. Ike was 9 votes short. The leader of the Minnesota delegation, Senator Edward J. Thigh, leaped to his feet and asked to be recognized, whereupon he switched his state's votes, formerly pledged to Stassen, to Eisenhower. Other delegations rose to do the same, making a second ballot unnecessary. By the time all the votes were counted, Eisenhower had 845 votes to 280 for Taft. Governor Warren, still hoping a deadlocked convention might turn to him as a fallback choice, held on to his delegates until the bitter end. And for the Taft delegates in Chicago, the end was indeed bitter. The sharp-tongued New Yorker correspondent Richard Revere took the measure of the Taft supporters. Nominating Dwight Eisenhower was an act of hard sacrifice and self-denial for most delegates here. It was clear from the time the first throngs began to gather in the lobby of the Hilton that a lot of them, including those who wore "I like Ike" buttons the size of saucers, really did not like the general at all. They grumbled publicly over a fate that forced them to reward a man they regarded as a parvenu, an amateur, a boob, and a heretic of sorts. Said one forlorn delegate about Taft, "My God, I love him. It kills me to have to do this to him." In fact, the right wing of the party would never forgive Eisenhower or be reconciled to his leadership. Eisenhower could offer an olive branch to these disaffected Tafties in his choice of a vice presidential running mate. He and his advisers would not consider the darlings of the old guard like Taft himself or MacArthur. But Dewey suggested just the right man for the job. The junior senator from California, Richard M. Nixon. At first glance, Nixon was not an obvious choice. He was only 39, the youngest Republican in the Senate. He'd been in politics for all of 6 years, and before that had been a struggling lawyer fresh out of the Navy. In late May, a poll of national political reporters discounted Nixon as a nominee for the second spot on the GOP ticket. They expected Warren or Senators Everett Dirksen of Illinois, William Noland of California, or Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts. Of the 50 leading writers interviewed by Newsweek magazine, only one thought Nixon would be chosen. Yet, Nixon did have some attractive features for the Eisenhower team. His youth would counteract Eisenhower's 62 years. His home state of California would balance out Eisenhower's New York residency and the impression of Dewey's influence. And he was both a conservative and an internationalist, who had the respect of the old guard and the Taft camp, while not being beholden to them. He had also developed a reputation, appalling to some, thrilling to others, as an avid red hunter, the man who unmasked Alger Hiss, the dapper State Department official who had passed secret documents to a communist spy. Nixon seemed an almost ideal candidate for vice president, Brownell suggested. He was young, geographically right, had experience both in the House and Senate with a good voting record, and was an excellent speaker. According to Sherman Adams, Eisenhower wanted above all a vice presidential nominee with a demonstrable record of anti-communism. The Eisenhower campaign strategists needed an aggressive campaigner on the ticket. In Nixon, they got their man. Dewey had had Nixon in his sights for some time. In May 1952, he invited Nixon to speak to an audience of leading New York Republicans at a dinner at the Waldorf Astoria. Dewey introduced the young senator as the tough, courageous fighter who had exposed Hiss. Nixon knew the speech was an audition for national office and treated it as such. "I devoted a full week to preparing it," he later admitted, though he spoke without notes, having memorized his remarks. He laid out a strategy for winning the presidency, stressing the survival of the nation, which was under siege by international communism. After the speech, Dewey invited Nixon to his suite at the Roosevelt Hotel and told him he was on the short list for vice president. At least 2 weeks before the Republican convention, Dewey, Clay, Lodge, and Brownell settled on Nixon as their choice. Just after Eisenhower's nomination was secured, Brownell and Dewey convened a meeting of 24 leading Republicans at Chicago's Hilton Hotel to consider vice presidential nominees. For an hour or so, a desultory discussion considered and ruled out Taft, Dirksen, Noland, and Governor Daniel Thornton of Colorado. Dewey then spoke up. "What about Nixon?" he asked. as if the name had suddenly popped into his head. He spoke eloquently about the strengths Nixon would bring to the ticket, and within a few minutes it was settled. Brownell left the room to place a call to Eisenhower, who approved the choice. Brownell then called Nixon, who was napping in his underwear in a stifling, un-air-conditioned hotel room near the convention hall, and told him to come meet Eisenhower at the Blackstone Hotel. Nixon and his trusty aide, Murray Chotiner, jumped into a limo with a police escort, dashed uptown to the hotel, and were ushered into Eisenhower's suite. Nixon, always sensitive to slights of any kind, was acutely aware of the enormous gap of prestige and power that separated the two men. Just a few years earlier, he had been a junior naval officer doing desk work in New York City, when Ike was driven through the streets to a hero's welcome. Peering out a window on the 20th floor, Nixon could just make him out through the snowstorm of confetti. Now he stood before the famous general, who formally asked him to join his crusade. Nixon accepted eagerly. July 11, 1952 was the most exciting day of my life, he wrote 10 years later. But there was no warmth here. Despite his great capacity for friendliness, Eisenhower also had a quality of reserve which, at least subconsciously, tended to make a visitor feel like a junior officer coming in to see the commanding general. And no matter how hard he tried over the next decade, Nixon would never close the distance between them. With the ticket now set, Eisenhower delivered his acceptance speech to the convention. He declared that he would lead a great crusade for freedom in America and freedom in the world. Today is the first day of our battle, he told his Republican followers. The road that leads to November 4th is a fighting road. In that fight, I will keep nothing in reserve. And by his side would be the brawler Dick Nixon. In a memorable backhanded compliment, Eisenhower praised Nixon to the assembled delegates as a man who has shown statesmanlike qualities in many ways, but has a special talent and an ability to ferret out any kind of subversive influence wherever it may be found. 3. Was there any Democrat in 1952 who could beat Eisenhower? With Truman out of the picture, the Democratic Party seemed rudderless. Estes Kefauver desperately wanted the nomination, but he was a nakedly ambitious, self-centered maverick and widely disliked in his own party. Vice President Alvin Barkley, much loved by Democrats after many decades of public service in Congress, was, at age 75, too old. Averell Harriman, with a distinguished career as an ambassador and public servant, had close ties to the liberal wing of the party, but he was painfully awkward as a public speaker and probably too rich to be appealing to Democratic voters. And there really was no one else, except, perhaps, for the one-term, reform-minded, moderate governor of Illinois, Adlai Stevenson. Stevenson, a rumpled, affable man with a bald pate and a fringe of dark hair around his ears, looked like everyone's favorite English professor. Or perhaps the town pediatrician. He had a gift for combining light-hearted wit with soaring idealism. At the Democratic National Convention, also held in Chicago, the delegates heard a kind of talk they thirsted for like weary travelers crossing a desert of parched rhetoric. Intemperate criticism is not a policy for the nation, Stevenson said, chiding the Republicans. Denunciation is not a program for our salvation. What counts is not just what we are against, but what we are for. Listening to the convention over the radio 1,000 miles away in New Hampshire, a young, aspiring reporter named Mary McGrory heard Stevenson's words crackling through the night. Stevenson's speeches seemed beautiful to me, she confessed. Politically speaking, it was the Christmas morning of our lives. Although Stevenson had deep reservations about running for president, his party clamored for his leadership, and on July 26, nominated him as its standard-bearer. To reassure Southern Democrats, the convention added Senator John Sparkman of Alabama to the ticket. a New Dealer, but a man who had consistently opposed civil rights for African Americans. Liberals, ignoring Sparkman, cheered Stevenson's high-minded invocations of good government and his paeans to FDR. Where Eisenhower spoke the simple vernacular of the